Today at Reader's Corner, Tom Lin, acclaimed author of the new novel, The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, novelist Tom Lin joins us to talk about his debut novel, The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su. In the book, a Chinese-American assassin in the 19th century American West sets out to rescue his kidnapped wife and exact revenge on her abductors. A twist on the classic Western, this one without John Wayne, the novel is a New York Times Book Review editor's choice. A powerful debut from what best-selling author Jonathan Lethem calls an astonishing new voice. The book is also the winner of the 2022 Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. Tom Lin, a graduate of Pomona College, is a PhD student at the University of California, Davis. The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su is his first novel. Tom Lin, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I have to start with, can I assume you're in the English program there at Davis?
I am, yes. Yeah. Although I have a what's called a designated emphasis in science and technology studies. I'm currently reading a lot about nuclear weapons because that's part of my research. And so it is the English part is kind of it's one half of it. But I often get asked, aren't you doing a thing with English?
Well, this is the question I usually ask at the end of the conversation that I have with authors. But since you brought it up, does that suggest that your next novel is going to be far away from the 19th century American Western and maybe something dealing with the other part of your education?
I mean, that's, I figure why do research for only one thing when you can kill two birds with one stone?
Yeah. Well, you really did a great job with this one. And I guess the first question I have is, I don't interview many authors who are still working on their degree as their books make the New York Times Book Review editor's choice, not to mention a number of very favorable reviews. And again, I don't know whether our listeners really appreciate what that means. There are so many good novels and nonfiction out there, and authors are lucky if they get one review. If they're really lucky, they will get one review. It may be the New York Times, maybe the Washington Post, maybe Amazon, whatever. But you piled up three or four really nice reviews that I was able to read in preparation for this. In addition, of course, to reading the entire book, I really enjoyed it, especially the ending, which we're not going to give away here. But how surprised were you by this book's success? Is this something, you knew from the beginning, I'm going straight to the top here? or wait a minute.
I was absolutely floored kind of every single time. Because, I kept on thinking, at some point my luck's going to run out and like something terrible is going to happen. And I did make the mistake of Googling my own book and just to see what other people have said about it.
Yeah.
And, now I know you should never do that. You should absolutely never do that. Instead, nowadays, my excellent publicist and my very patient girlfriend, both of them screen reviews, and they only send me ones that are suitably complimentary. But I think it was each time I was kind of floored that someone else had read it and liked it. I think it's a very antisocial activity, writing. Because until you've actually published it, you're pretty much just participating in this kind of, voluntary delusion.
Yeah.
you're no fun at parties. But I was definitely really, really honored, and I continue to be. I mean, I'm blown away. I when I was a kid, I dreamed about being a novelist, and that dream kind of atrophied or withered on the vine as I kind of learned about money and financial things. But I remember resolving to be as close to books as I could, and that's why I studied English in undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
And before I started my graduate studies here at Davis, I remember thinking, if I don't really just try to write this book, there's a good chance I'll never write a book in my life. And so I had an extremely grueling year or so where I really tried to write the book, and thank God I finished it.
Yeah.
But I think part of that was the trepidation about, having to do academic work and creative work side by side.
Right. You mentioned the word research. Did you need to do much research as far as 19th century Western is concerned?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, contrary to popular belief, I'm actually not 150 years old. And so I did have to do a lot of research. The good thing was, you know, I was raised in New York City. And so my family's still there, my mom and my grandparents. And so during college, I would take that as an excuse to do these like long road trips back and forth.
Uh-huh.
The crazy thing about the Transcontinental Railroad, which is, you know, which features pretty centrally in the book, right, is that even though today, you know, the actual tracks of that original railroad are mostly unused, it still structures the way that we kind of live our life in this country. The 80 follows the railroad almost exactly, you know, just a couple miles distant at some points, mm-hmm, pretty much from here until Omaha, which is really convenient if you're taking a road trip and you want to learn about the tracks, because all you have to do is just pull off on an exit and then, you know, check out satellite view and see how close you can get.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of research because I find writing to be very difficult, especially fiction, because with fiction you can tell any story and it's like deciding what to eat on a weeknight. You know, mm-hmm, you have to, you're spoiled for choice, and so you kind of get paralyzed. And so the more research that I did, I found it was easier to stabilize the story. And it was a way of procrastinating that felt productive. Mm-hmm. So I ended up doing a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And I tried to go to the places that Ming goes to in the book and try to take notes and pictures and really get a sense of what it felt like to be there.
Well, you did an excellent job of that, because the landscape is so beautifully drawn up in this novel that, you know, I live in Boise, Idaho, and I spend a lot of time in the West. And I really did, you know, feel like I was there. Now, that's a long way from where you originally came from. I think it was you were 4 years old when you moved to America from China with your parents. Somewhere I read something about how you viewed yourself in those days that in one sense connects with the plot, or at least it connects with Ming Su, the protagonist of your novel. He's an immigrant. And you have some experience with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was born in Beijing, and we actually left China when I was two, but to Australia, okay, I think, because they had a little more. I think the plane ticket was cheaper from Beijing. That's what I've been told. But after 2 years in Australia, we ended up going to New York, and that's where I grew up until I went to college.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, it's this interesting kind of in between place to be for me, because there's ways in which I'm read, right, where in America I might be too Chinese to be American, and then I'll go to China and I'll be too American to be Chinese. And uh-huh, so there's this middle ground, you know, that is totally indeterminate, that I think it was definitely caused me a lot of grief as a kid. And I remember when I was really young, you know, I remember like thinking, oh, I wish I weren't Chinese, because then life would be so much easier. And it wasn't because I was upset at my heritage, but it was simply because it seemed to be the thing that was preventing me from fitting in.
Right.
And I think that, you know, I don't want to generalize, but I suspect that is how a lot of immigrant children feel. And I think a lot of that is because of the media that, you know, we consume and the kind of the cultural attitude towards what is American and the kind of the unspoken cultural attitudes, mm-hmm, specifically those around, you know, whiteness and class. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I think it's improving, because there's all these new works coming out that really center people in America who are not white, but yet, you know, incontrovertibly American. And I think that is definitely just a positive. Like, I think that's, without any reservations, a really good thing to be happening. Because I remember when I was first writing stories as a kid, you know, just like in my composition notebooks, all of my main characters were white and they were talking with other white people, which was, you know, now that I think about it, it was insane, because I went to a public school in Queens and I hardly knew any white kids. And so I was writing these kind of stories that pretty much had the realism of fantasy, because I was writing about experiences that I had only kind of heard about secondhand. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started writing stories that featured Asian Americans where I felt I really was beginning to hit my stride and kind of discover what I wanted to think about and what I wanted to write about. Mm-hmm.
Well, before we get too much into our conversation, why don't you set this novel up for our listeners? I could do that, but that's not like the author doing it. And I think you're in the best position to do that. So tell our listeners exactly what this is about. And again, we always reserve the right to take a pause when you get toward the end, because we don't want to give anything away here. This is a great ending.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Here's the pitch then. A Chinese-American assassin starts in Salt Lake City, and he's trying to make his way back to Sacramento. He's being hunted by the men who first abducted his wife and put him away to work on the railroad. And he's got a gun and a railroad spike, and he's going to make sure that everyone pays for what they did. And along the way, he hooks up with this magic show that feature performers with supernatural powers, and he has to protect them, and he grows to love them. And I think that puts us within striking distance of the end without revealing it.
Yeah, right. So you mentioned the magic show part. Part of that magic show was a scam, as I remember it. One guy in the show in a cage, maybe, you know, wasn't exactly who he was. He was billed to be. Is that correct?
Yes, there is a shapeshifter who his power is that he can become a double of someone else. Mm-hmm. And for much of the book, he is a double of the ringmaster, because it's a form that he views to be more accessible and more safe. And it comes to it has pretty serious consequences for him.
Yeah. Well, now I'm talking about Proteus. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, Proteus.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a fascinating part of the book. Well, where I'm going with this is that were these magic shows for real back in the old days? I know there were these traveling circuses that were moving from town to town. This where you embellished a bit?
Yeah, so the traveling circus is absolutely, I mean, that's where it got its start, is in the 1860s. But the magic show is, I mean, it's just, I thought it was just fun to put in, you know, superpowers and the supernatural. Because I think the other thing is, you know, you go to these landscapes, you walk through the West, and it does feel magical. It does feel like something could happen there that can't happen anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, you know, I might as well just go for it and kind of introduce that magic, because I think part of the reason that I was so interested in doing research and getting everything right was that you're kind of building a pact with the reader. You know, you're setting out this agreement, which is that, you know, I will show you things that are true. I'll show you history and I'll show you, you know, what it was like to be alive at that time. And you can have faith that I really did the research and, you know, I'm trying to get it as right as I can. And so once we have that trust, you know, I'll show you magic. And it's my hope that, you know, the groundedness of the history and the factual parts of it will kind of bleed over,
mm-hmm,
and make that magic feel even more real as well.
Yeah. I got a kick out of the fact that these reviewers were having a tough time settling on one description of your book in terms of the genre. You know, well, it's a Western, and no, wait a minute, it's historical fiction. Well, there's magical realism. That's a pretty nice accomplishment, be able to cram all those things into one reasonably sized novel.
Yeah, you gotta keep them guessing. I've seen the book in Western. I've seen the book in literary, and I've even seen the book in a section adjacent to fantasy. So that's as close as we've gotten to that.
Right, right. You're listening to Tom Lin. He's the author of The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su. So I also saw that in one of these reviews, you were compared to Cormac McCarthy. I mean,
I know.
And I got to tell you, and I have to tell you, that's when you got my attention, okay? I mean, let's face it, his work's has found its way to the big screen. And another question I usually ask authors in your position is whether or not anybody's come after you with a screen option yet. I bet they do.
I mean, the book has been optioned
for
a television series. Yeah. And so, you know, we're working hard on that right now.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, you'll see it on the smaller screen, but silver nonetheless.
Oh, that is really great. I'm looking forward to that. So will you have a role in the production of any kind?
Yeah, so I am. I think my official title is executive producer, non-writing executive producer, because I've got all these notes and this research and this background, and you know, I've got all these character bios. So I think it would be they would have a much harder time if I sat out, I think, because I've got all the really detailed, insane history behind it. But yeah, so, you know, we're all working together on that. I've got a fantastic team. They're all really pulling for it. And I think it's in good hands.
Yeah. I mean, that's just amazing to me that you're there in a PhD program and you're sitting next to some student who's just trying to figure out a way to get the assignment in by next week. And you're talking to Hollywood about an option. I mean, this is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I teach this composition class, you know, and it was at 8 a.m. this quarter. And I gave my intro, and I was like, my name's Tom Lin. I'm a PhD student here, and I wrote a book last year. It's been pretty well received. And, not one of my students even blinked. One hand goes up. Is this essay the only assignment for this quarter?
Right. That sounds very typical of the classrooms I taught in once upon a time.
They're like, all right, then. Yeah, it's the only assignment.
Right. So was there a Chinese assassin somewhere in the history of railroad building in the American West? I mean, it wouldn't be too far-fetched if there was, but maybe you didn't find one.
As much as I'd love to tell you that I found the guy, I didn't.
Yeah.
And part of that is, I mean, like, you know, I think, was there a Chinese, like, criminal for hire? Like, there's a good chance of that, but the real story is that we have almost no documentary evidence of firsthand Chinese experiences from that era, simply because they were never saved. Mm-hmm. You know, the archive is this process of like deciding what to keep for posterity and deciding what doesn't need to be kept, and pretty much everyone who kept an archive at that time decided that the Chinese workers' stories were unremarkable. And so what we have instead are these kind of accounts at once remove, journalists moving through the trains, kind of, you know, observing these camps. We have work orders. We have letters written about the Chinese workers. But we have no, and I really mean this, we have literally no firsthand stories from them. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of dead letters in these Chinese Association offices in San Francisco that, you know, these letters were either weren't picked up or weren't sent out. By whatever, you know, for whatever reason. And that does provide a little bit of firsthand flavor. But in general, you know, we have almost this kind of archaeological project. And that is actually what happens these days, actually, is archaeologists will go to these old sites of old Chinese mining towns and literally, you know, go and dig up and try to figure out what it was like to be there. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's in that kind of unsettled history that Ming Su kind of comes in as a character of possibility.
Yeah.
Rather than one with kind of historical precedence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm speaking to you from Idaho, and of course the Chinese came to Idaho, but my understanding is that it was mainly for mining. And of course the dark part of this story is that it didn't end well, as I'm sure you found in your research, if you didn't know already, that these Chinese eventually were unwelcomed and in some cases dealt with very violently. And of course, then there's the Exclusion Act. Did you mention that? I think you might have mentioned that in the book, but maybe not. I might have read it somewhere else. But obviously, that's the thing that really put a stop to the immigration, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. But, there's a great new book out. I think it came out last month or 2 months ago by Jenny Tinghui Zhang called Four Treasures of the Sky.
Oh, that's it.
And that one's fantastic. And that is set in Idaho.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there is a long history of, you know, Asian Americans as the other, this kind of like archetypal figure that American culture used to point to kind of indicate that's them. And so by indicating, you know, what the other is, they actually stabilize their own identity.
Yeah.
And so the integration of Asian Americans into America has always been, I think, kind of fraught with violence and rejection. But the Exclusion Act is really interesting because it's the only, I mean, it remains, it's the first and, you know, hopefully will remain the only law that has ever been passed restricting movement into America of a particular nationality. Mm-hmm. There's a very kind of noticeable effect, among the Asian American community, especially the Chinese community in America today, because there's these kind of two pulses of immigration. So you either have, you know, Chinese Americans who've been here since the 1800s or since the last, you know, 40 or so, 40 or 50 years.
Right.
And there's a long gap in between. And I think that the way that you know, these laws can kind of leave demographic marks, I think, is always really fascinating and kind of troubling.
Yeah. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Tom Lin, author of the novel The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su, which has been optioned for a TV series. So forgive my ignorance, but since this is about the Chinese in America in the 19th century and a novel that has been so well received and praised here in America, will the Chinese see this on their bookshelves?
I'm happy. You've asked at a wonderful time, because that is, we actually just inked that translation deal. So yes, it will be translated into Mandarin, which is a delight, because that means my extended family no longer has any excuse not to read it. And so, you know, I'll really be assigning them homework as soon as it's out.
Exactly. Exactly. I can give them a test. So Tom, Ming Su, rather, he has this traveling companion, a fellow Chinese immigrant, the Prophet. And the Prophet refers to Ming Su more than once, I think, as a man out of bounds, maybe to help our listeners understand Ming Su, who he was and what he was up to. What's that mean, a man out of bounds?
Yeah, so within the book, the Prophet is referring to, the Prophet has this clairvoyant ability. He has no memory. He can't make new memories, so he has no memory of his past. But what he does know is the future, and specifically what he knows is the date and time of every person's death. And there's only one person that he can't see that for, whose date, you know, whose death day keeps changing, and that's Ming. And I think one of the things that I wanted to explore was this question of, you know, determinism and agency. To what extent are you able to shape your own future, and to what extent does it kind of happen to you? And I think throughout the book, Ming is trying to win back his agency. You know, he was an assassin, but he was an assassin for hire. And so he has kind of lived his whole life up to this point as this kind of pattern of actions that have been structured by others. He hasn't actually gotten to decide anything for himself. And so, you know, one broad view of the book for me is that it's a story of winning the right to self-determination, the, you know, winning the right to step out of bounds and to make your own life as you see fit.
It's also a novel about revenge, and by the time I got to the last page, I came away with, I guess, what you call the moral of the tale. Is there any way you can tell or share the moral without giving away the ending?
Yeah, I think I would say that the a spoiler-free way of saying the moral is that revenge makes you consider at the end what it was all for.
Well put, because again, we don't want to give anything away. I was also absolutely fascinated by the way you took the language of the 19th century. This is where I could tell you did some research. I didn't know California was California back in those days. Did you find much of that, where the structure of the language was remarkably different than what it is today in 21st century America?
I mean, I think like the California one is a great one, and I think it actually shows up in some early Steinbeck too. I think it might show up in Grapes of Wrath. But that one, yeah, that's a little dialectical. You know, they just clip the ends of words, and you know, also the transformation from thank you to thank ye.
Yeah.
But I got a book of you know, sayings and phrases from the 1800s, and I think I love the feel of old language, and I love kind of writing from this modern perspective and trying to incorporate and recreate that feeling of old language. And I think a lot of it is in these like little phrases that they have peppered in. So not so much the structure of the words changing, but kind of the timbre, if that makes sense. And so one example that I really like is this phrase, in all creation, you know, there's nothing in all creation or you know, be pulled like all creation. Mm-hmm. There's a much more present kind of biblical or religious aspect to this old English, you know, not old English, but 1800s English, that I find very evocative. And so it was a lot of fun to kind of, you know, look through the phrase book and kind of figure out where I could put those in, And, you know, if you do it for long enough, as I found out, you begin to kind of, that's how you begin to think.
Yeah.
And so it makes you very old timey, at least for a little while.
Yeah. At first, when you mentioned thank ye, when I first came across that, it was kind of thrown off. I thought, I pictured somebody in New England for some reason saying thank ye, you know, a Yankee. and then to learn later that, no, this is the lingo. This is the way they talked back then. That's pretty interesting. Well, there is one thing that I have to ask you about. It's the mountain lion. So, you know, we really aren't not giving it away by just saying bluntly what happens in this case. Ming Su is in his last effort, the most difficult part of his journey to get to California and over the Sierras, and he's confronted by a mountain lion that isn't the kinds of mountain lions I've heard about here in Idaho anyway, in terms of what they would do to you. And I'm just curious, how'd you come up with this? I mean, this is something that the reader, I think I really grabbed onto that. I thought, now that's really cool. This is different than you would expect.
I think for me, I've always liked, you know, this kind of relationship between humans and animals. I think there's this line that we draw for ourselves kind of cognitively. You know, we say like animals are over there and humans who can think and use reason are over here. And every time I think you interact with an animal, you're trying to kind of draw that line in the sand again and again, and you keep finding that it gets very blurry. And I think I've always really loved kind of those human animal interactions. And I think another thing is that, you know, I think we've all had those moments where like an animal does something that like really kind of amazes us, that is kind of marvelous. I think they kind of give a hint of maybe having agency or maybe even having, you know, knowing something that we don't. And I thought, you know, why not just bring that up all the way to 10, to kind of have this kind of mystical experience with an animal where you feel finally that, you know, the animal is not kind of like a participant in a system, but actually the system itself is, you know, you're moving through nature and this entire world is speaking to you, you know, not only through the landscape and you know, the trees, but also even in the animals, that there's a way that the land can welcome you and guide you, even when no one else will.
Right. And in this case, the mountain lion did, and we'll leave it at that and move right on. So we talked briefly about your other studies in technology, nuclear, whatever. Are you at work on something that would be a novel in that area or wherever?
I am currently at work on a second novel. It is going to be speculative fiction, and I've got the outline is beginning to come together. I think I'm a very slow writer, so I don't want to make any promises, but it is on its way. One interesting thing is that, you know, I'm trying to do this kind of firsthand research, for the experiences of, you know, like what it would be like. And I'm contacting people who've written memoirs or something like that. And they're all very cagey because it is, you know, a matter of national security. And I think they're rightfully suspicious when someone emails them out of the blue asking them for, you know, more detailed descriptions of nuclear silos. But it's going well, and I'm really kind of you know, beginning to enter into the world of this next story, which I think is very satisfying. And so with any luck, you'll see it, let's say, sooner rather than later.
Great. Well, I'm going to be looking forward to it, I'll tell you that, and I'm sure our readers and listeners will be looking forward to it once they finish The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su by Tom Lin. Tom, it's been a delight talking with you today, and I wish you the very best and can't wait to see The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su on film. Have a good day.
Me as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care now. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.